Hello, and welcome to Volume 119 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll talk about leasing hunting land. We'll discuss how to obtain financing for forest land purchases. We'll discuss capital gains and estate planning, and we'll check in on the latest with timber prices. I'm Hayes Brown with the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Our first guest is Johnny Thompson, managing partner at Landmark Spatial Solutions. We wanted to talk with him about a new product that his company provides called Terrain Navigator Pro.
Terrain Navigator is a desktop mapping application that's been around for a little while. You download it onto your computer, and it includes very detailed topographic maps. It includes aerial photographs of different dates. It's got a very detailed street map layer. And then it also has got, recently they added in a parcel data, a kind of land ownership data, and that's been very helpful for a lot of our clients all across the South there that want to be able to look up and see ownership data, who owns the property next to them, and how do they get access to a property. So it's really been a very exciting product, and with that, there's also a mobile side. So a lot of people here today are wanting to use their iPhones or Android phones or tablets to access mapping type or photographs in the field. And Terrain Navigator's got a very easy to use mapping component for the smart devices as well.
Well, I can see why it would be helpful to a forest landowner, but take us through some of the things that a forest landowner could do practically with the product.
You can open up the application and you can see immediately all of the parcel boundary data, which would be, again, in your area of interest if you're looking for property or if you want to know who owns property around you. You can also take the tools and digitize tracks or stands. You can digitize that in an area. Say you wanted to put a pond in on your property. You could easily kind of click around and see not only the topo version, but you also can lay an aerial photograph in there. And there's also a way to actually go into a 3D mode. So I've seen landowners that have taken the program and say, well, this should help me find a good spot to put a pond on my property or locate something like that. I want to put food plots in. I wonder, you know, how big that food plot area should be. You can print off very good maps. It's just the thing that I would emphasize more than anything else. We work with a lot of different programs, our company does, but Terrain Navigator is very easy to use. You don't have to have any kind of background in GIS or mapping to open the program. You can search property owner. You can search by address, by town. It's very easy to just kind of drill in anywhere in the state, really, on a particular property, and then look at it. Once you identify that property, you can very easily draw something off, and it will automatically synchronize with your phone. So it's just, you just kind of walk outside on that property, and you'd have that property drawn off on the smart device. It's very easy to use.
Okay. All right, how much does it cost, and where do I go to get some more information?
So the cost for the desktop part of the program is $400. The cost for the ownership data is $100. And so you're kind of pay for the desktop, and then the ownership you would actually pay for on an ongoing basis, because they are continuing, as these counties update their ownership data and put that out there. Trimble Navigation, which is the one that owns this product, they are implementing those updated ownership data into the application every year. So it's kind of an ongoing, there are some ongoing costs, but you're getting a lot for that.
$100 it would be an annual license fee.
It is. The $100 is for an annual license fee, and there's also about a $125 annual fee to run the program. So it's a little bit of an ongoing cost. They are updating the photographs about every 2 years in the program for Alabama, and they're updating the ownership data every year. So there's some programs you pay for, and you don't really see a whole lot of bang for your buck. In this application, we've seen a lot of payback for that kind of ongoing fee there.
Okay.
There also is, Hayes, a mobile-only version. Say you're not really a computer person, you do have kind of an iPhone or an iPad or something, and you would like to see this kind of data in the field. There's $100 one-time fee you can pay for that, and that would give you access to topos, ownership data, and if you had some sort of cellular coverage, you could also download photographs and things in the field as well. So
okay, and that'd be a one-time fee. Yeah, two different versions. Okay. Well, great. Well, thank you, Johnny. We appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. And more information can be found on our website, and that's just landmarkspecialsolutions.com.
All right. We've got that on the screen. Thanks a lot. Our next guest is AFOA board member Henry Barclay, who we've asked to comment on forestry and taxes. Hello, Henry.
Hey, Hayes. How are you doing today?
What's the latest on what's happening with capital gains and expenses that relate to timber?
Well, Hayes, that's really the issue. It's a matter of what's not happening and what could happen. As you remember, there was a huge total tax reform effort that occurred back in 2012 and 2013 under the Camp Ways and Means Committee. And that culminated in a draft bill that came out of Ways and Means in February 2014. And during that time, there were lots of proposals. The forest interest groups made suggestions. They commented on the bill. And now we've got a change in leadership. And with that, we've got a new committee chairman, Kevin Brady from Texas. Well, that bill, which took a lot of time from the committee, is below the horizon at this point. But the committee, and this is the important part that timber owners need to understand, the committee's got the same staff. And that staff invested a lot of their life into this bill and the research for it. And what I'm hearing is that the committee staff is still solidly behind the bill. So it appears to be a sleeper, one of those bills that's already ready, could be pulled up at any time, and we don't need to lose sight of it because there's something that's important to us, and we need to alert our senators and our representatives to make sure that anything that happens in the future gives timber owners three items of access. One of those is the ability to deduct our current operating expenses, including our silvicultural costs. One of them, obviously, is capital gains, because we make a long-term investment. It's only fair that we get capital gains on the sale of timber. And the other one is the ability to deduct and amortize expenses for planting and replanting timber. And I can tell you, none of these are in that bill. In the resource material that I attached to this presentation, you can access your representative, your senators, members of the House and Senate committees. And, Hayes, at this time, I would just urge timber owners to stay in contact with their representatives and their senators to make them aware of the issues that are close to them, and particularly these three issues, because we may well see this bubble up in the future. And, as you know, it's easier to take a seed off the ground and throw it away than it is to try to get rid of a fully developed invasive plant.
Okay. Well done, Henry. Thank you for that and keeping us informed and keeping us proactive. We appreciate that very much. An AFOA favorite and returning guest is Robert Tufts, a forestry professor at Auburn University who specialized in law and timber, especially estate planning. Welcome, Dr. Tufts.
Morning, Hayes.
I've learned that you've developed a web page that's got some information on estate planning and so forth. Can you tell us about some of it?
Yes, I've started my next phase of my career. I retired from full-time teaching at Auburn, but I'm now working part-time for the Alabama Cooperative Extension System. And one of the first things I did was put together a web page on basic estate planning. And I believe y'all have a link to that on this presentation, so I urge people to visit.
And what's it got on it?
Mostly it's basic questions. Obviously, I can't answer everything. So it pretty much covers the gamut from basic estate planning to probate to taxes. I even have some forms out there. The Advanced Directive for Healthcare is a standardized form published in the Code of Alabama. Alabama also added a power of attorney 2 years ago. And I even have a simple will out there that just something to look at.
Oh, good. Okay. Why do you think it's important for landowners, especially forest landowners, to think about estate planning?
You know, the typical plan is all to my wife if she survives, otherwise equally to my children. And what most people don't realize, this creates a tenancy in common, which means all the children have to agree on the management plan. And I've seen many families where that doesn't happen. And when the children can't agree, the only remedy is to either divide the property among the children if they can agree to that. If they can't, then the court is either going to divide it or sell it. So you need to do something to prevent that division of the property.
Why don't you tell us about some sort of alternative to that simple will concept?
Well, what I've been doing is recommending that landowners consider either a trust or a business entity to hold their land.
Okay. That'll help take care of some of those difficulties that you mentioned.
Right. Well, and what we're trying to do is keep from having to have a family meeting every time we decide to spend $10. So if you have a trust or a business entity, basically you are appointing either a trustee or a general partner or a managing member, and that can be one or two or so people, and they actually make the decisions, but the children can all benefit equally from the financial side, but you just don't have to get everybody involved in decision making.
Okay. Are you presenting some workshops, I hear, around the state?
We are. We're going to do a series of workshops on estate planning for landowners. We'll be advertising these in the AFOA newsletter. The first one's coming up in Lauderdale County on February the 22nd. We don't have enough details to give you information on the following workshops yet.
Okay. Well, we'll keep in touch with that. Thank you, Dr. Tuss. We appreciate that very much.
Thanks, Hayes.
Brad Butler is a real estate broker who deals with forest land. We wanted to talk with him about financing the purchase of forest land. Hello, Brad.
Hey, Hayes. How are you doing this morning?
I've been hearing from some people that banks are being very stingy about lending money for purchasing unimproved land like forest land. Is that your experience?
That is totally incorrect. You hear most of that stuff from people that sit around and watch 24-hour news stations all day long, and they've got to fill time, so they talk about the financial crisis and not getting loans anymore. But, you know, we've seen with good credit, you can easily get a loan at 85% value, 25 to 30-year term, 4.5 interest rates. Our main lenders, First South Farm Credit, Alabama Ag Credit, Alabama Farm Credit, you know, they didn't participate in any of the subprime mortgage crisis and came through, you know, the recession fine. Even during the deepest times, we've had no problem getting approved buyers' loans.
Okay. Well, that's good news. Are there any alternatives to purchasing forest land that don't involve just paying cash for everything or going through a traditional lender like you're talking about?
There is. There's several properties on the market and some that we have now that offer owner financing where the current owner of the property will finance with a down payment. Normally the down payment needs to be around 20-25% down, but you get away from a lot of your lending fees and, you know, the cost of appraisals, things like that. And the terms are, you know, normally 10 years or so to get it done. And you can always do a self-directed IRA where you use your retirement money to have a tangible asset in your retirement growing and use that property. And, you know, each year, each time you cut timber, it goes back into the IRA. And then, you know, when it comes time to retire, you can sell that self-directed IRA. Sell the property and, you know, and cash out the self-directed IRA. And your taxes, you know, are pretty much the same as anything that would be, you know, your regular IRAs.
Okay. And at those rates, you know, the 4 and 5% rates that you mentioned, an owner financing might be in that range, maybe even a little bit higher. And those sound like pretty attractive rates. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're pretty attractive rates. They're as cheap now still as they've been in my 20 years of doing it.
Okay. Well, thank you, Brad. We appreciate that. Kiva Larson is chairman of Larson & McGowan, a forestry consulting firm. We learned about a proposed listing under the Endangered Species Act about something called the black pine snake. and also the critical habitat rules that go along with that. And we want to talk with him about it. Welcome back, Keeble.
Thank you. Thanks.
Just looking at this black pine snake's range, it looks like it's very small, and it's confined to about 20 counties, mainly in Alabama and Mississippi. Why should the broader public be interested in watching this particular listing?
Well, I think the main reason is that there are 400 candidate species in our region for, and this particular listing has a lot of gray areas in it and questions that aren't answered yet, and seems to almost set the precedent for saying, well, just ask us and we'll let you know what you can do, where previously most of the requirements have been pretty clear, and you could look at it and make a decision on what you needed to do.
Mm-hmm. They're defining what's called critical habitat. Is that real clear in your mind?
Well, the words that they describe, they say it's federal lands or federal or public lands that have a federal nexus. Well,
right.
When they talk about a nexus, they talk about involving permits, funds, or licenses from the federal government for private lands. And that leaves some questions.
Mm-hmm. Well, it begs the question. I think part of this is on a military base, Camp Shelby, and some things like that in the areas that have been drawn, but other private land that may have some connection to the federal government through cost shares or other things, at least raises that question.
That's right.
Is there a problem with, are they focusing on longleaf stands? Is that kind of where these snakes are typically found? And are there potential restrictions in managing longleaf stands as we normally have?
Well, yes, I think all of us know about the longleaf, and for this snake, it's in a particularly small area of the range of longleaf. But they recognize that active management is necessary to maintain habitat, things like burning and maintaining an herbaceous understory and open stands. And that's why they've put in what they call the 4D rule, which allows you to do normal management activities like burning and even herbicides and harvesting. But then there are others that they would not allow, such as anything that disks or destroys the soil. They say, no, that would not be allowed. So there's some that they do allow and some they don't.
And I guess road building would be in question, and certainly conversion of that stand to another use, house or a development or something.
Well, conversion is a big one. The road building, I think you could be careful with, but on the conversion, no, they don't. They say it would be a taking to convert it to loblolly pine or pasture or agriculture land, and so. This is one of the first times I know where they have put in a rule that says, wait a minute, you cannot do this with your property. Previously, with things like the gopher tortoise and the red cockaded woodpecker, they're identifiable. The landowner or anyone else can go out there and find them and see them. And so you can be careful and work around those areas. But with this black pine snake, they live in holes in the ground and cover a lot of area, and it may limit the entire tract you have just because there is one somewhere nearby.
Okay. Well, thank you, Keeble. We appreciate you keeping us advised about that.
All right.
Kim Nix is the Information and Education Chief for the Alabama Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. You might be familiar with a magazine that's called Outdoor Alabama. It gives a lot of information about hunting and game laws and regulations and so forth. Hello, Kim.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Kim, I understand the department is changing the publication method for this particular magazine now, and going to be now email subscription. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, everyone kind of knows that state agencies are really under some budgetary restrictions, and we certainly are as well. So we've had to cut back on some of our printed matter, and that would include Outdoor Alabama Magazine. But we are offering a sort of alternative to that. We have a website, of course, outdooralabama.com, and lots of information on there, but that requires someone actually coming to us and finding the information. And what we wanted to do was deliver specific information just to people who were interested in particular topics. We found that some of our sister states, such as Georgia and Florida, were using a device called Gov Delivery. We looked into it and found that that was just what we were looking for. So it's a way to deliver specific email communication to our constituency.
Okay. What are some of the topics that you, if you sign up for the email subscription, you might likely see?
Our two most popular are our monthly newsletters. We have one that's called Outdoor Alabama Newsletter, and that kind of gives you an overview of what the department's doing. We also have one specific to state parks, and that tells you what's going on at state parks, some of the issues that are happening. And we have over 50 topics that you could sign up for. So if you're just interested in state parks or you're just interested in saltwater fishing, we have topics that you can sign up for. And I want to stress how easy this is to sign up for and the fact that you only get what you sign up for. We're not sharing your information with anyone else, and it's very easy once you start receiving this information to opt out at any time.
Okay. We have a link, I think, for that process, and there's no password.
That's correct. We're collecting just your email address, and something that forest landowners might be interested in is our wildlife and conservation news topic. We really try to provide useful information about different things that people who are managing for wildlife would be interested in, such as prescribed burning, specific wildlife that they might have on their property, deer, black bear, turkeys, things like that.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Kim. While deer hunting season is drawing to a close about this time, we wanted to talk to Joe Rigsby about his experiences in helping his clients to get top dollar for their hunting leases. Welcome, Joe.
Hello, Hayes. Nice to be with you.
Joe, in your work, what size tracts do you typically lease for hunting?
Well, anywhere from as little as 20 acres up to well over 1,000 acres. And you find that the smallest tracts draw the most attention. It seems that a person who is wanting to hunt and knows nothing about it has a choice of either joining a hunting club or trying to lease property for himself. And any good hunting club is going to cost you well north of $1,000 a year. So if he can lease a 40 or an 80 for that much money or about that, he'll do it. And I get a lot of demand for small tracts.
Okay. What is the range of rents that you see?
Anywhere from as little as $10 an acre up to $30 an acre. I got $30 an acre for one track last year.
What tends to push it toward the higher end of those rents?
Any improvements you might have, any hunting improvements you might have, such as food plots, shooting houses, tree stands, et cetera. And the smaller the tract, the more per acre it's going to bring. It is late in the season, but the most valuable part of the hunting season is still ahead of us because the rut has not started. And in South Alabama, south of Highway 80, the season has been extended to February the 10th to allow the rut to come on in time for the hunters to take advantage of it. So I just leased a little 20-acre tract just 2 weeks ago for $600.
Oh, during the season, the season's already started and you leased it.
Well, yeah, almost the season, probably half over, but the hunters who know hunting, know deer hunting, know that the most valuable part is not yet arrived, the rut.
What we've noticed that you have done an auction, for lack of a better word, of several tracks, and you've asked that they make a bid by a certain date. How did that turn out for you?
Worked out real well, and the reason I used it was mainly just to get more money. Competition brings more money, as all forces know who ever bid off timber, and hunting leases can work the same way. What you have to do is prepare yourself for a lot of phone calls and a lot of emails, and you get a lot of aggravation, and you'll get to talk to some people who sound like they probably wouldn't know how to get out of the rain. But that's just part of it. And one thing you need to do when you do this is prepare a little package of maps and information on a PDF file and have it queued up so that when you get emails or phone calls, you're ready to send that information out immediately. Because when people are doing this, they're on it. They need a place to hunt. And I like to sometimes wait until way over in late summer or fall to do it, because there's a lot of people who want to hunt and just plain don't know how to go about doing it. So if you can get it out there for them to take a look at and make up their minds, you can get real good rain.
Okay.
I had a 40 last year that I put out for bids, and I got bids that ranged from $280 to $1,060, 21 in all. And I had 99 acres in Montgomery County that I took bids on. It has an old house on it that's been fixed up as a camp. And I got $3,000 for it. And I had 19 offers to a low of $750. The guy who leased it is from Manchester, Tennessee. And he called and said, "I'm making you a preemptive offer of $3,000. He was thinking that would just blow everybody away. But the next high bid was $2,860, so he left very little on the table. But it had an old house on it that he could bring his son to. He said, "I want my 11-year-old son to have a chance to shoot a buck, or shoot a deer at least." And so I've not talked to him since he leased it. I don't know if he got one or not, but he should, because there's plenty of deer there. And that's the kind of people that are attracted to these small track bid offs.
Okay. All right. Well, that's interesting, Joe. Well, thank you for that, for sharing those experiences. In our markets chairs, Yenny Smith, the marketing director and staff editor for TimberMart South. Hello, Yenny.
Hello, Hayes.
All right. Tell us what the latest is for timber prices in Alabama.
Well, as of fourth quarter of 2015, stumpage markets for pine saw timber and pulpwood have been relatively flat in Alabama, hovering around $24 per ton for saw timber and less than $10 per ton for pulpwood, which is similar to where pine prices have been southwide. But hardwood saw timber has been a little higher, about $10 more per ton than the southern regional average, and hardwood pulpwood prices have been about $5 higher in Alabama.
Oh, okay. Well, it helps to have diversity on a track, doesn't it, or have tracks with different types of trees. If you have only one thing, you're kind of stuck with some of these prices, but you're pointing out some differences in different species.
Absolutely. Well, with hardwood saw timber and pulpwood prices in general, they've been a little stronger these past couple of years, especially in a handful of southern states, which includes Alabama. And there are a few reasons for this. First, competition. So among the mills in Alabama, as well as what you're pointing out, you know, track size, track quality, and diversity of different products that you can offer. All that can mean price premiums. Second, weather. Last quarter was rather wet, which meant less accessibility to hardwoods, and which also leads to increased prices. And finally, markets. That's really important because U.S. southern hardwood isn't all domestic like it is for pine. So exports of hardwood, it's a strong component of the hardwood demand. And on the domestic front, the number of housing starts have improved slightly, which generates some hardwood demand. And there's been some increased demand for cabinets and furniture and cross ties.
Okay, good. Well, thanks, Jenny. We appreciate that perspective. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Johnny Thompson, Henry Barclay, Robert Tufts, and Brad Butler. We also appreciate the contributions of Kiva Larson, Kim Nix, Joe Rigsby, and Yenny Smith. Forest owners are not typically thought of as being on the cutting edge of technology, but it shows how much potential there is there to learn and explore about the use of technology and in what was once a paper and pencil world. We've talked about drones in past issues, and today we've touched on new websites for estate planning, ways to get hunting information online, and auctions for hunting land, and also new applications for mapping and measuring property. So if you're intimidated with technology, just pick one thing this year to break the ice and see if these new ideas are helpful to you. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.